All right, so Chanukah and Miketz. Parashat Miketz always falls on Chanukah. Which means by definition, there has to be a connection between the two. So I'll tell you a story. And the Shana Bet guys remember this from last year, because I go back to this moment. Sometimes there are experiences where you kind of remember a moment, and sometimes you make a decision that you want to remember a moment. So I decided a long time ago that I want to hang on to this moment every year on Chanukah. Hey, shh. Canellis, you with us here? Okay, shh. So this was, I don't even remember exactly what year, but I was already an officer. And we had come down from Lebanon. And we, And we were, thank you. And we had come down to our base on the Bika in the Jordan Valley. And you know, going to this base, on the one hand, it was actually difficult after being in Lebanon, because Lebanon was very intense. And all of a sudden, you're in the Jordan Valley, you're in the Bika, and it's basically boring. You're on a very quiet stretch of border, and for the most part, you're just doing patrols up and down. Most of the soldiers don't have much to do. So the powers that be decided that this would be a good time to service the tanks. And there were some tanks that were overdue for an engine change. Changing a tank engine is a major seaport. It's a major story. You have to open up the back of the tank. You have to undo like hundreds of different screws and lines, whatever. You need an expert. They have guys who come from the reserve and do reserve duty, like tank mechanics who show you how to do it. It's a miserable thing to do. You're working on the tanks like all day, all night, disconnecting it. It doesn't always work right. You can't figure it out. Then you get a new engine, and you gotta put the new engine in. And in addition, you're doing everything else. You're servicing the tank treads, and you're greasing the tank and oiling the tank. And it's just an enormous amount of work. And by the time you're 2 hours into the day, you're soaked. You're covered in grease and oil, and just like it's depressing, right? And because I was the officer on duty, so I was responsible for making sure that all the tanks were getting all the service they needed to. So in addition to the fact that I had to work on my tank, I was running back and forth and being on top of other tanks, right? And I don't know quite how this happened, but it's hard to explain. But when you're in the army and you're in tents, whatever, you're not always aware of like the day, the week, whatever it is. And I had completely forgotten that it was Kislev. I had completely forgotten that Chanukah was coming. You know, it's not like Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. So much going on to prepare. You hear the shofar. You remember. What do you do 2 days before Chanukah to realize it's Chanukah? So if you're not out in the civilian world, you're not seeing jelly donuts. You're not seeing Chanukah sales. You're in the army. And somehow, it was like 2-3 in the afternoon, and somebody came by and asked a question. And based on the question, because they were asking if there was anything special at dinner, I'm like, why would there be something special at dinner? And he looks at me and goes, well, because it's Chanukah tonight. And I suddenly realized, like, it was Chanukah. And I was the only guy in my unit. There was one other guy in the other plugah, and he was not there. The only guy in my unit with a kippah. Right? So the guy was kind of in shock, but I had no clue that Chanukah was coming. I can't even begin to explain it. It was so depressing. Like, I had done nothing to prepare for Chanukah. I had no candles. I had no oil. I had no wicks. I had nothing. I was filthy. And I was thinking, I was stuck in the army. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what kind of Chanukah is this going to be? You know? And I'm generally a positive person. I try to put a positive spin on things. And, you know, especially in the army, like, you know, keep on my head. I would make it a point to try to always be in a positive space. So the reserve duty guy, this Milovnik, older fellow, who was working with us on the tanks and helping us, he walks by a second later and he sees me. And he looks at me and goes, Makalecha. Like, what happened to you? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, Ataneveh, you look like the world fell out from under you. I said, yeah, I just realized it's Chanukah tonight. So now he gets this puzzled look at his face. He said, okay, so it's Chanukah, so why are you looking down? You should look up. So I look at him and I'm like, because look where we are. I'm covered in grease. We're working on these tanks. We're in that garbage heap of life, right? And like, where is Hanukkah? He looks at me and goes, like, what's the matter? He walks away. Okay. And it wasn't enough that I felt that I was bummed that I had no Hanukkah. It wasn't enough that I had prepared for Hanukkah. I didn't know what I was going to do about lighting Hanukkah candles. On top of it, I probably just made a chiddush. Like, that made me just feel like if it wasn't on the bottom of the, you know? And I was just like, oh, what a bummer. Anyway, it gets dark. And, you know, guys were closing up the tanks to go back, grab a shower, whatever it might be. And we're going to go to dinner. And there was supposed to be an Aruchah Chagigit. Right? They put out, what does an Aruchah Chagigit mean? So if it's Shabbat, it means you dress up in your dress uniform. Here it just meant they would have some extra cakes or something, or they'd give schnitzel instead of the usual garbage, whatever. Wow, I'm so excited, you know? And I'm like getting off the tank, and everybody's kind of like, I look around, and I realize there's only a few guys left, and, you know, we should go to the dining room. And this Milanik comes back, this reserve duty guy, and I'm like, oh, he probably has another thing he wants me to do. He goes, Boiti, come. And I had been told by the deputy battalion commander, like, for this week, he's your commander. Like, it doesn't matter that he's only a sergeant. Like, he's experienced, and we're checking the tanks. Whatever he says goes. So he says, come, I go. Right? He goes, boom. Right? So we go to the other end of the mishtach, the other end of the bitonara, this deck where all the tanks are. And there's like a pinat shmanim. There's like a big, you know, all the ammo. Because when you service the tanks, like, there's tank shells and things. Dangerous to work on them. So you take all the stuff off and throw it in a pile. It's part of the fun of, like... And he looks and he finds a box and he finds a couple of shell casings. He picks up a shell casing. Now, you ever see, like, the shell casing from a bullet? It's like this big, right? Okay? So, and if you've ever seen one, you know it looks like the bullet is out of it. It's just the shell casing, the hollow... So a tank shell casing looks exactly the same, except it's this big. Okay, it's called a talmil, all right, of a pagaz, of a tank shell. It's 105 millimeter, whatever. And it's like this round and this long, right? And he picks one up, and he throws it at me. You know, whatever. He goes, bo, right? And he picks up another one. He says, come, okay? And then he grabs a thing of flannelite, which is like the stuff that you use to wipe off grease. And I'm like, oh, God, what does he want me to do? He wants to... We use these things for all sorts of things. You can raid a Jeep on them instead of a jack. You can use it to help clean the gun on the tank, whatever it is. And he's got the flannelite, like the rags. I realize we're going to have to scrub something. I don't know what he wants from me, right? And then he goes to the back and he picks up a couple of cans of oil and he says, boom. And we start walking. And we leave the mishtach tanking. We're leaving the tanks behind. I don't know where he's going. What he wants from me, right? And I'm just annoyed. Like, you know, which is worse, depressed or annoyed? You don't have to worry, because I was both, right? And we're walking, and all of a sudden we're getting close to the dining room. I'm like, what is he doing? And I don't know what he's doing here, right? And he gets to the front of the dining room, and he throws the stuff outside the dining room. So I think, oh, maybe we're going in to eat, but I'm disgusting, right? And he walks over, there's a pinat kibui esh. There's an area that is outside of every building on a base in the army. That's like a fire station, like... In case there's a fire, fire extinguisher, and all this different stuff. And one of the things that's always there is an et hafira, it's like a big shovel. So that if there's a fire, you can, you know, dig dirt and throw dirt on the fire, sand, whatever it is, right? There's a pinat chol. He picks up the shovel, right? One of the shovels there, and he starts digging. And he's digging, and he's digging, and I'm looking over it. Finally, he says, nu, yalla, right? Come. And he takes one of the shovels, he throws the shovel at me. I'm like, what? He says, nu. Okay, so I take the shovel, and he says, nu. Right? Start digging. So I start digging. I don't know what he's doing. Okay? He's digging. I'm digging. We dig a hole. Hole's about this deep. Right? Then he stops digging. He takes one of the 105 millimeter shells and he puts it in the hole. And he starts taking dirt, sand, and he starts putting it in the thing. I think he's whacked. He's whacked out of his brain. I don't know what he's doing. Right? Then he looks at me and goes, no. I'm like, what? He gets this look on his face, like, oh man, how did you get through officer's course? And he picks up the other 105 million thing, and he sticks it in the hole I dug. And then he starts, right, and I realize he went, and all of a sudden I get it. Like, you know, like the light bulb goes on. He's making the biggest menorah I've ever lit in my life out of 205 millimeter shell casings. And I suddenly get it. So I get this smile on my face, like, wow, because I was so bummed. How are we going to light candles? I'm going to light the Wahan Menorah. This is unbelievable, right? So we put the sand in. And after we put the sand in, then we put there, he brought two kinds of oil. One kind of oil that's not so flammable, it burns slow. And then some benzene, which is kind of burns, whatever, right? And he pours the oil into the sand, and it soaks the sand, and then it's like on top. He pours the benzene on top. And then he rips some of the flannelite, and he makes a wahad wick, and he dips them in, and he sticks them outside. right? And I figure, okay, right? And I pull out a lighter, and I'm about to light. Like, I'm like, this is amazing. He goes, Makalacha, what's the matter with you? I'm like, what? Lechtikale kulam, go call everybody. I'm like, nah, I wasn't wearing my rabbi's hat. I was an officer. Like, I happened to have a kippah on my head, but it wasn't my... So I feel like, okay, like, it's a good point. Maybe somebody wants to light. So I walk into the dining room, right? And, you know, people see me, right? People are sitting down and starting to eat, whatever. And I kind of yell out, if somebody wants to light Hanukkah candles, we're lighting Hanukkah candles out here. Now, the battalion commander was sitting at the table at the front. He was a bit of a nutcase, but that's another story. And the deputy battalion commander and the MP and whatever. And the battalion commander gets up and he says, Ladlik Niyamot Hanukkah! Right? You're going to light Hanukkah candles? Boom! So he gets up and the deputy battalion commander gets up and they start walking out of the dining. Now, if the battalion commander gets up to go out to light candles, and you're a company commander, you go with them. And if the company commanders get up, so the platoon commanders get up. The platoon commanders get up, the sergeants get up. Pretty soon, the whole base, 200, 300 guys, they crowd out of the dining room, okay? And they're all standing outside, and they make this big circle around the candles, right? And he looks at me and goes, Achav tadlik, now light, right? And I'm like, no, this is you. Like, what a mitzvah you just did, this is you. He goes, right? He says, no, you're going to light, so fine. So we light the candles, you can imagine. I mean, it's like, you know, Laila hafach leyam, you know, like all of a sudden the night turned into day, like it's unbelievable. Like, could you imagine? Like, you're in the Israeli army, you're lighting Hanukkah candles to remember that we conquered the Yevanim, the Greeks, that Melucha, that the royalty, kingship, monarchy returned to Am Yisrael, that the Nispach Shemen, that Judaism survived. And where is the Greek Empire? And here we are, right? Okay? And I'm about to light, right? And he goes, Raiga, Makalacha. He goes, Tagid Mashu. Like, say something. You're going to light candles, say something. Now, of course, today in a right, oh, I'd say something and somebody would have to say enough, light, whatever. But then, so I said, La, ta Tagid Mashu. He said, no, use. No, really, you should say something. He said, Limnik, you're older. He says, this is tough. So he stands up, he says, Tov, az achshav bini yagid lanu kama milim. Right? Bini's now going to say a few words, right? Slice me. So I don't even remember what I said. You can imagine the Greeks, the Israeli army, 2,000 years, here we are, Yishtabach Shem. And we lit the candles, you know? And it was a powerful moment. And when it was all done, and they sang house tour and whatever, and then we went inside, and we had dinner. And all of a sudden, I was in Hanukkah. I wasn't on the tanks, and I wasn't in the grease. The grease was on my uniform, but I was in Hanukkah. And I, instead of sitting with the officers, I went to sit with this guy. Because I was annoyed. He didn't really know guys on the base. I went to sit with him. And I said to him, like, what's the deal? Like, that's amazing. He doesn't have a kippah on his head. Right? I didn't even know that he had a... And, you know, like Ravadi said today, he just pulled one out of his pocket. One of those guys. So I said to him, what made you... That's unbelievable. He said, I haven't missed lighting Hanukkah candles since 1973. That's what he said. Now, he didn't look like he was born in 1973. And he didn't look like he was bar mitzvah in 1973. So I said, okay, what's the story? And he told me the following story. Unbelievable. He said that when the Yom Kippur War broke out, he was one of the soldiers on the Suez Canal. Or he came down as part of the reserves to the Suez Canal, I don't remember. And they got into this very intense battle. Very intense battle. And the Egyptians had anti-tank weapons. They had the newest anti-tank weapons. And they were taking out Israeli tanks left and right. And it was like a shooting gallery. And everywhere he said at one point he looked around him, and everywhere he could see, tanks were just bursting into flames. And he said, I don't know why, but I got it into my head. There was one point where I was looking and we were firing, and he said, look, I'm just a loader. I'm just doing what the commander says to me. So he says, you're really not in control. Like, you don't know what's going to be. And I looked out, and for some reason, it looked like a menorah. It looked like Hanukkah candles. And for some reason, I said, if I survive this, I promise you, he makes a deal with God. He says, if I survive this, I promise you that I will light Hanukkah candles forever. That's what he said. And he said, ever since then, this is my night to celebrate the miracle that I'm alive, that my family's here, and I light Hanukkah candles. And I said to him, who knows? but that you survived everything so that you could get to this Hanukkah. Because what you did this Hanukkah is unbelievable. Right? And I realized, it all depends on how you look at it. You could just be stuck in the mess. Right? You're stuck. You're at an army base. And there's nowhere to go, and there's no party, and there's no latkes. You're just stuck. But you know, a Jew is never stuck. You're never stuck. A Jew isn't stuck. A Jew is sent. You're there for a reason. And you got to figure out what the reason is. So I want to share with you an idea. I'm not going to make this a long shiur. You know, the Hanukkah break is coming. But I want to share with you an idea, possibly two. So everybody knows the story of Yosef and the brothers. Yosef gets sold as a slave, right? And the brothers don't seem to have much remorse. And the next thing you know, Yosef is in the pit. First he's a pit as a slave of Potiphar. And then, as if that isn't bad enough, they throw him in the pit. And then he interprets the dreams of the baker and the butler, and they forget about it. And he's as miserable and as forgotten as you could imagine. If there was ever a character in Tanakh that you would expect would leave it all behind and dump the whole thing, the whole nine yards, it would be Yosef. And the next thing you know, all of a sudden, Yosef's out of the pit. He's standing before Paro. And he's dressed in these royal clothes. And Paro has these dreams, right? Parshat Mikates. And if you look at the beginning of this story, right? The beginning of Parshat Mikates, what does it say? Vayhi Mikates Shnatayim Yamim. After 2 years. That's a very strange way to start a parsha, but we're not going to go there. At the end of 2 years. Paro cholem, v'nei omed al hayo, right? Paro dreams two dreams. First he dreams about 7 cows that are fat and healthy. And then he dreams that there are 7 sickly cows. And the sickly cows eat, they consume, they swallow the fat cows. Okay. And then he has another dream. And it's interesting, if you look at the language, it says vayishan, and he goes to sleep. Vayachalom shenit. He dreams again. He dreams a second time. And it's interesting that this dream is a little different, but it's not so different. 7 barley stalks, they're healthy, they're fat, right? Or wheat stalks, depending, right? And then there are these sickly stalks, and they consume the healthy stalks, whatever. And for some reason, Paro has a freak out. He has a freak out. Now that's the first question. Why does this freak Paro out? I mean, can you imagine, you go to sleep at night, and I don't know, 7 rats come along, and they crawl into your dorm bed, and they consume you and 7 of the bachrim. That'd freak you out. But if you dream that 7 jelly donuts were eaten by 7 green beans, right? So, I mean, it'd be weird, but it wouldn't freak you out. But then you have another dream. The other dream, 7 hamburgers. They're consumed by 7 cucumbers. Like the vegans are taking over the world. Now, I can understand that might freak you out, but it really wouldn't freak you out. It wouldn't be so strange. Why is it so strange? Why does it bother Paro so much? And then, nobody can explain this dream. Really? Nobody can explain this dream? All the brilliant dreamers, all the witches and the wizards, it's such rocket science. Maybe there's 7 years of plenty, fat cows and fat stalks, and then there are going to be 7 years of famine. And you know what's amazing? If I tell you that the interpretation of that dream is that 7 people are going to drop dead at 3 in the afternoon, and then 7 people drop dead at 3 in the afternoon, then I can understand Paro's like, whoa, that's amazing, Yosef, you're the man. But he says 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. What would you do if you were Paro? Some slave, like, put aside the fact that this slave is being taken out, and all of a sudden, I mean, you know, President Trump, you know, can't figure out the dream, right? And all of his advisors can't figure it out, you know? So, I don't know, he calls Rav Davidel's son. You know, was he 3 years old? He calls him to, he says, come, like, that's ridiculous. Like, you call it Nebuch. He goes to New York City, sees a homeless guy. There's a homeless guy lying on the ground. And he knocks on his shoulder. He says, bring me that guy. And they strip this guy, but he stinks. He can't get near him. He says, go clean him up. So they clean him up, and they bring him to Smith Barney, and they put a nicer, and they bring him before it. And he says, how do you understand this? What should we do in the Middle East? And the guy looks at him, and he says, I think you should declare Jerusalem the capital. right? So you think Trump would say, "Oh, that's a great idea. Like, that's ridiculous. What does Yosef have to do with Paro? And why does Paro listen to Yosef? And what does this have to do with Hanukkah?" And there's an interesting line that Yosef has here. He says, "Ve'al hishanot achalom." This is in Perek Mem Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Bet, right? 41:32. And by the way, there's almost like a by the way comment. Like, there's a whole long soliloquy Yosef gives him, but then he just adds a detail. He says, by the way, the fact that the dream repeats itself, al hishanot, shenit, hishanot achalom, right? El paro, pa'amayim, the fact that it happens twice, ki nachon adavar meim Elohim, this shows that this is, now what does nachon mean? This is coming nachon from God. So Rashi explains what's nachon? Mizuman. This has been prepared. And the commentators explain, u'mimaher Elohim la'asoto. This is coming now. Where did Joseph get that from? What does that even mean? Because you had two dreams, it's happening in a hurry. If it was just jelly donuts being eaten, so then maybe I'm just a jelly donut freak. But because they're also with the hamburgers, oh, we're immediately going to have a steak dinner. Like, what does that mean? So I want to share with you two deep ideas. And I think it'll be pretty obvious how this relates to Hanukkah. You know what we're really celebrating on Hanukkah? You know what this battle was really about? People like to idolize that it was the Jews against the Greeks. It's not so simple. People who are historically more accurate will talk about the Greek-like Jews who basically fought a civil war with the more traditional Jews, Prussian. You know what this is really about? There were two ways of looking at the world, and they were at odds with each other. And eventually, one of them had to win. You know why the Mitzrim, why the Egyptians, they couldn't solve the dream? They didn't understand the dream? Because the solution to this dream is to look at the world in a completely different way. A fat cow, in the Egyptian way of looking at the world, in the Egyptian way of thinking, cannot be consumed by a thin cow. Because the fat cow is stronger. The fat cow is healthier. And we know that in the world of nature, it's the strong that survive. Right? The Egyptians were pagans. They were idolaters. And one of the foundational principles of idolatry is the worship of nature. The power of nature. The beauty of nature. Right? The higher up in nature something is, the more it's to be worshipped. That's why the Greeks, by the way, they felt... What is highest in the world of nature? Who is highest in the world of nature? Man. It's not animals, it's man. Man rules the world. Torah tells us man rules the world, right? Urdu bidgat hayam v'ofer shamayim v'kivshuha. We're supposed to conquer the world. That's how the Greeks could worship the human body. The ultimate beauty of physicality. And that's how the mightiest person in the world, by definition, becomes a god. Antiochus was called Antiochus Epiphanes, which means I am God, basically. The emperor was declared God. Offering a sacrifice to the emperor was showing fealty to the God of the Greeks. Right? To us, it seems ridiculous. But that's how they looked at the world. Whoever is most powerful conquers and wins. Might makes right. That's what the Greeks believed. The Greeks believed that the power of nature, who was the king of all the gods? Zeus. Right? The most powerful of the gods. And so if something's more powerful, then by definition, it must overcome. You know who else believed this? You know who else believed that we had lost this way of thinking? And that it was time to bring the world back to this way of thinking? Want to take a guess? Adolf Hitler. I'm a big believer you should read what your enemies write. You know? I remember when Yitzhak Rabin and Carter and Menachem Begin, you know, and Sadat, they all got together and they celebrated the peace with Egypt on the White House lawn. As much as it was scary, you had a sense that something was happening here. There was a change. And I remember, I have a vivid memory. It was 1978. I was 15 years old. I was in high school. And I got home, and my parents said, we're celebrating tonight. And we had a whole dinner. I mean, burgers and steaks and whatever. And my father broke out a bottle of white wine, I still remember. And we each had a l'chaim. And we watched on television as they signed the ceremony. You had this sense that we were a step closer to where we were supposed to be. And I'm not commenting on what Sadat intended and whether you just had a sense, an Arab, the mightiest Arab nation at the time in the world, Egypt, which really led the Arab world, in the space of less than 7 years, turned upside down and signed the peace agreement. It was unbelievable. And you didn't know what it was going to be, but you had a sense that something was changing. There was a genuine desire to see if we could have peace. Some 15 years later, in 1993, when Yasser Arafat and Bill Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin did that very hesitant handshake, you can look it up online, you didn't have that sense at all. You didn't have that sense that there was something happening. You didn't feel that we were getting back together and the peace was in the world, because you didn't feel that someone had changed the way we looked at the world. And I remember reading, I was less interested in what Yasser Arafat was saying in the press to the West. I was much more interested in what he was saying to the Arabs. And when you listen to what he wrote and what he said, you realize we weren't any closer to peace. So you want to understand Adolf Hitler? If the Jewish people had read Mein Kampf in 1930, there might not have been a Holocaust. So, it's aside from the fact that it's a bestseller, which is nauseating to say, it's a terribly written book. Half of the book is ramblings. It's just, you can't even follow it. But there are moments of lucidity, and there's one piece that he speaks there. He writes in this book, and he actually explains why he hates the Jews. Adolf Hitler said he hated the Jews because he could never forgive them for bringing God into the world. Because when the Jewish people introduced the concept of a God into the world, then might no longer makes right. Right? Ki lo v'chayil v'lo b'koach ki'im beruchi amar Hashem. Judaism believes it's not about who has the greater army, and it's not about who has a stronger muscle. It's about the spirit. It's about the ruach. It's about who's right. It's about who wants to make the world a better place. Hitler's entire theology of creating an Aryan race, of the fact that might makes right, that the Germans should retake their place at the pinnacle of society of the world because they're the mightiest nation industrially, physically. That's why they were so into the Olympics in 1936. Right? Who messes up that perception? The Jews. Because the Jews are still around after 2,000 years and they're certainly not mighty. And the Jews believe that something is right not because you're strong, it's just right because it's right. Right? The Greek way, the Western way, the pagan way of looking at the world cannot possibly understand those two dreams. The idea that a healthy cow would be consumed by a sickly cow, that the downtrodden, the lost, the persecuted Jewish people would still be here, and the mightiest nations of the earth. Think about Malos Tzur. We don't only sing about the Greeks. You would think you only need to sing Yevani Nik Batsualai, the stanza about the Greeks, but we speak about the Babylonians, Kates Bavel Zerubbabel. We speak about the story of Purim, Agagi Ben Amandata. We speak about Paro, about the Mitzrim, right? It's about the fact that the Jewish people, despite it all, are still here. It's a battle of a way of looking at the world. It's the victory of the fact that the world can be a better place. And it's particularly Yosef. What does Paro say? Paro says, Ani, right? Ani chalamti, I dreamed the dream. What does Yosef say? Fayan Yosef et Paro? Biladai. It's not about me. Elohim yaneh shlom Paro. This isn't about who's smartest, and it isn't about me. It's about something bigger than me. Hilchoteh, straight through. So that's why the Egyptians could not possibly comprehend this. And that's why someone from a completely different... Paro finally figures out the way we're looking at the world means we can't see this. We need somebody who sees the world completely differently. And that's the Jewish people. And there's one more idea worth mentioning. So what is this? Ve'ali shanota chalom el Paro. The fact that the dream is repeated. Ki nachona davar mim Elohim. That God is coming to... What does this mean? So let me ask you a question. You're Yosef.
You're swept out of the pit. Okay? It's Tuesday afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. And you're a slave in a pit, forgotten by everyone. By everyone. You've interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker, and again you've said, right? Elohim yaneh et shlom, right? Ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Peter Arot HaChalom. He's the one who solves the dreams. And not only has your father Yaakov forgotten you because he never came looking for you, not only have your brothers abandoned you, not only has the master you worked so hard for believed Potiphar's wife and dumped you in a pit, even the butler and the baker were your fellow prisoners dumped you, and then it seems as though God has forgotten you. So you would think that in that pit, Yosef is done. There should be nothing left. In fact, you wonder why Yosef doesn't kill himself. It's unbelievable. Where does a person get that faith from? And the next day, an hour later, he's standing in front of Paro. And Paro says to him, I had two dreams. And you got to solve them for me. Now come on. You're Yosef. You're standing in front of Paro. You're pulled out of a pit. It's unbelievable. And he starts talking about two dreams. What do you automatically have to be thinking of? His own dreams. That's just too much. 22 years later, or actually 14 years later, you're being introduced to two dreams again. And so Yosef says to Paro all of a sudden, I just figured it out. Because when you dream a second dream, Nachon hadavar meim Elohim, u'mimaher Elohim lasvato. Nachon, says Rashi, this has all been part of a plan. It's prepared. And it's coming. It started. This Yeshua, this salvation, is not now. I'm not being saved. Yosef's talking as much to himself. I'm not being saved because I'm standing in front of you and all of a sudden I'm wearing a suit. I was being saved when I was thrown into the pit. This whole journey, every single stage of this journey was a part of reaching this moment. And he looks back every moment. And that pit was as much a part of my journey as this pit. And those dreams were as much a part of the journey as these dreams. And the story of Yosef teaches us that no matter how dark life gets, no matter how deep in the pit you get, that's just part of your journey. We don't always understand it. It's clear that Yosef has no idea what Hashem is planning for him, but that Yosef believes that there's a plan. And we may never figure it out, and we may not merit to know, but there is a plan, there is a bigger picture. 2,200 years ago, the mightiest empire on the face of the earth, Antiochus, after Alexander the Great dies and Seleucid and Ptolemy, his two generals, fight it out in battle and carve up the world, of all the different nations and all the empires and all the battles, who's the one that you figure is done? The Jews. They're done. And you know, Alexander did something that was much more difficult for the Jewish people. When the Babylonians came along, they basically said, unless you accept our pagan way of life, we'll destroy you. And they destroyed what? They exiled 10,000 tribes. They burned the Beis HaMikdash. The Persians had the same philosophy. Not the Greeks. The Greeks, Alexander didn't say, I'm going to crush you. Alexander just said, come on in. Join us. You're welcome. You can come into the gymnasium, share our philosophy, wear our togas. It's unbelievable. If you study history, the Jews, for the first time, by a foreign empire, were welcomed. This was a challenge Chazal, the rabbis, had no idea how to deal with. This is a very difficult question. What do you do? Right? And the yeshivas started to empty out because the Bachrim were going to the gymnasiums. They left Baba Kama behind. They were studying the Cleveland Browns, which, by the way, is the wrong one to study, but whatever, right? That was very difficult. The Greeks, it seemed, had welcomed us in. And then we experienced Yosef. You know, one of the phenomena of Yosef, the world of Yosef is like this. 1 minute Yosef is walking, he's got a technicolor coat, he's on top of the world. And the next minute, he's in a pit. 1 minute Yosef is in a pit, everybody's forgotten him, and the next minute he's instead of Paro. The story of Yosef teaches us that whatever today is, tomorrow can be totally different. And if you're a Jew living in America, Do I believe personally that there are going to be pogroms and the Jews are going to be marched, God forbid, into gas chambers in Teaneck next week? No, chas v'shalom. Do I think, if you read the map and you look at what's going on in the world today, would I trust that the safest place to bring up my grandchildren is in America? I don't think so. Not if you read the map. What's going on today in the world is scary. And you kind of wonder if the world of Yosef is coming back. You know? There are two ways of looking at the world. And Hanukkah is about celebrating the idea that there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger plan. That we're on a bigger journey. That it's not about who has the mightiest army. Think about it. The fact that Israel is a superpower technologically is ridiculous. We're 0.01%. We're nothing. It's unbelievable. How does Israel have so many Nobel Prize winners? And how is it that so much of technology, it doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense. The fact that Israel has basically, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has solved Israel's two biggest climactic problems, one of them being water, the other one being energy, is incredible. The fact that there are even Arab nations now that are secretly looking to get expertise from Israel is unbelievable. And it's not because we have an army. Every time a prime minister or a defense minister stands up and says, there will not be a Holocaust because we have a strong army, it makes me cringe. Because if you think that the reason that Israel is here is because we have a strong army, you have completely missed the point. And that is Hanukkah. If I think that the reason, don't get me wrong, I went to the army and I think it's important and at least you have to struggle with this question. And Baruch Hashem, that Hashem allows us to live in a state of Israel, to speak Hebrew, to have an army. But if you think the reason this state exists is due to the Israeli army, you are whistling Dixie. And that's exactly what Hanukkah is about. It's not about kochi v'otzem yadi, about might and strength and size. It's about ruach. It's about neshama. And you look back and you realize that when Jews were sitting on top of a hill and the Greek elephants and their thundering hordes were coming up the valley, there's a place in the Gush, in Emekah, above the Eilah Valley. It's not far from the Moetzav Alanshut. It's an actual site. They know exactly where this battle took place. And you can read the description in Sefer HaMakabim, in the Book of the Maccabees, about how they drew them up into the mountains, and how these guerrillas took on these incredible units with their African elephants that were the tank of their day. And Elazar takes a spear and he goes on. It's unbelievable to read these stories. But if you look carefully at Sefer HaMakabim, every time they're about to go out to battle, one of the officers stands up and he gives a shear. They had Divrei Torah before they went to war. It's unbelievable. Deep hidden in the story of Hanukkah is what really matters in this world. So, we're about to take a break. And I think Ben Azmanim is a misnomer. If you look back at some of the traditions, you can go online and see there is no such thing as Ben Azmanim. Ben Azmanim means there's a time to learn and there's going to be another time to learn. And this is like between the times to learn. This is not Ben Azmanim, this is Hanukkah Azmanim. There's an opportunity to see. It's a golden opportunity. Because when you get to like a whole month of Pesach, of Nisan, or 2-3 months in the summer, it's very hard. Will I be able to keep the momentum? Will I be able to grow? But to be able to do it for 3 days, that's doable. And you have to ask yourself, as we kind of take leave, are we leaving the Beis Medrash, or are we taking Beis Medrash with us? Is Torah dependent on being here in Israel for the year? Is this where you learn, and once you leave here, you don't need to learn because you're not in yeshiva anymore? Then what was the point of the whole year? But if the Hanukkah light goes with you wherever you are, then you really did something powerful. And the reason Torah is compared to light is just not for me. It's not just for us. It's how we make an impact on the world and how we share that with the world. So you're going to be out in all sorts of different places, and that's good. And you'll be able to taste and to see Eretz Yisrael and Bezrat Hashem. That'll be good too. And it should be safe, Bezrat Hashem. But if you don't take the light of Torah with you, then it means that everything we've been doing here this year is called into question. God bless you, Bezrat Hashem. You should have the most amazing break. It shouldn't really be a break. It should be an opportunity. You should grow. You should learn. You should bond. You should experience. You should enjoy. And then you should come back with renewed energy. And Bezrat Hashem, have an awesome continued one. Hanukkah Sameach, Bezrat Hashem.